Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies in collaboration with the Department of Education, entitled Approaches to Immigration and Multiple Identities. This talk was delivered by Ms. Mina Dysharp, Project Manager of the Bradford Community Housing Trust in the UK.
Hello, everybody. Good evening. Hi. First of all, thank you for coming. And I have been asked to welcome you on behalf of everybody else. Just to give you a brief, we're going to have two presentations, short presentations by Dr. Azzopardi and Dr. Galia first, followed by our guest speaker, Ms. Dysharp, at a bit later stage. Now, for those of you who would like to receive a certificate of attendance for having come to this public lecture, I have a list of all the people who have booked by internet. They're in alphabetical order. I'm going to put this round. If you don't find your name, you just add it at the end of the list. It's important that you write your postal address so that we can send it to you by post after the lecture is finished. I'll introduce the first speaker, Dr. Andrew Azzopardi. For those of you who don't know, he's a lecturer with the Department of Youth and Community Studies. His lecturing focuses on sociology, critical pedagogy, disability politics, inclusive education, community management, emancipatory research, narrative inquiry, youth, and community studies. He has had several papers published in journals of disability studies, reviewed books for British Research Association, and recently published a monograph, Career Guidance for Persons with Disability. Dr. Azzopardi is currently coordinating a Master's in Inclusive Education and Communities that is being offered by the Programme of Inclusive Education, the Department of Psychology. Okay. Dr. Azzopardi.
Okay. It's been a really positive experience for us three, and probably the most important issue here is the engagement that we tried to experience with the complexities of immigration, and of identities, which are two issues that we'll be drawing upon today. But probably our biggest experience was that we are trying to explore the fact that children want to be students and students want to be children, basically. So that is probably the crucial issue in our research. So perhaps we can start here, and there's a critical issue in this debate, which is intracultural variability. Within all cultures, there are variations of considerable magnitude. How are these differences to be addressed? For example, within any cultural group, motivation, social organization, and ways of speaking and thinking vary with education, income, and class status. Broad perceptions for Africans or Arabs are often resented by culture members who are not well described by these generalizations. Culture and education research has tended to focus on those members of cultural groups who do less well in school, something that, in my opinion, we need to explore more in depth. None of this invalidates the cultural level of explanation, but it develops a more differentiated grid for study that has not yet been achieved locally. I want to do a human rights argument this evening, but also a duty rights argument. It starts with people. It's about friendships, arts, culture, sports. It's about people living together. It's about being a full-paid-up member of the human race, as Tony Blair would have called it. I hope I haven't spoiled my relationship with you, Mina, by mentioning the bloke. Okay, we need to change the terms of political debate. We need to abandon the ridiculous self-imposed dilemma between principle and power. We need to go back to first principles, to our values, our real values, those that are timeless, and separate them from doctrine and dogma that have been ravaged by time. In so doing, we free Malta, we free our society from the reactionary choice that dominated politics for so long, between individual prosperity and a caring society. We can prove that economic efficiency and social justice are not opposites, but partners in progress. We need to defy conventional political wisdom and construct a new political coalition. Challenges are different, deeper, bigger, hammered out on the anvil of forces, global in nature, sweeping the world. Today, the challenges are essentially global. The world today is a vast reservoir of potential opportunity, prospects, and chance. But with these opportunities comes huge insecurity as well. And all of us who put the value of inclusion should engage in dialogue. We achieve it by talking openly about the problem. The very act of exploring its nature, debating and discussing it, doesn't just get people thinking about the country we want for today's world, but it also eases the anxiety. It dispels any notion that is forbidden territory. Failure to talk about it is not politically correct. It is dangerous. We need to reform welfare, education, health within a discourse of openness and dialogue. Let us be resilient. Let us give our communities the tools, but also the space to think, debate, and plan, to voice their discomforts, but also to listen to the explanations. We educators, academics, professionals, and service providers have a responsibility towards our community, towards the development of dialogue. Without looking deeply into multiculturalism, the need for closure becomes a thin veil for a tendency towards exclusion of underrepresented cultural groups. All of our practices and conceptualization require critical examination and change. We must begin where each child and each adult is at the moment. We cannot ask for action from a person coming to first awareness. We need to communicate so that awareness matures into making changes and taking action appropriate for our work, our place in the culture, and our place in the social system. Apaduri's 1996 definition of globalization speaks to the interdependence and integration of diverse, cross-border flows of people, capital, images, ideas, goods, and services. Cultural globalization is evident in the movement of international students and migration and migrant labor around the world. The ethnic, religious, and linguistic composition of multicultural nation-states is changing as a result of changes in the global national flows of students and labor. Together, these create a basis for viewing globalization in terms of transnational interactions of people crossing borders. Optimism is the belief that things will get better. Hope is the faith that together we can make things better. Optimism is a passive virtue. Hope is an active one. It takes no courage to be an optimist, but it takes a great deal of courage to have hope. Hope does not exist in a conceptual vacuum. It is born in the belief that the sources of action lie within ourselves. We are not unwitting products of blind causes. Multiculturalism understood not just as tolerance of cultural diversity, but as the demand for legal recognition of the rights of racial, religious, or cultural groups. Dialogue is being reopened. We need to have dialogue. The dilemma of immigration and identity possibly converges with the discourses of valuelessness. Some, particularly those in Europe, feel that they have evolved beyond identities defined by religion and nation and have arrived at a superior place. But aside from their celebration of endless diversity and tolerance, these some find it difficult to agree on the substance of the good life to which they aspire in common. Immigration forces upon us in a particularly acute way discussion of the question, who are we? Posed by Samuel Huntington. If societies are to move towards a more serious discussion of identity, they will need to uncover those positive virtues that define what it means to be a member of the wider society. If they do not, they may be overwhelmed by people who are more sure about who they are. So it's now up to us.
I'll introduce a second speaker, Dr. Simone Gallia. She's a lecturer in philosophy of education at the Faculty of Education here at this university. She has published papers in local international journals on philosophy of education, educational theory, feminism, multicultural and anti-racist education with particular focus on narrative research and genealogical modes of inquiry. She is currently coordinating a master's program in educational research, and as an educational researcher, she is working on a research project on the multi-ethnic school. She is the co-founder of the newly set up program of culturally responsive education within the Department of Education Studies.
Thank you. My talk will be about the idea of changing identities, and I will draw on my philosophical background mostly to reflect upon and particularly the ideas of Frantz Fanon to reflect on the idea of changing identities. It was a lovely spring day when I entered a primary school in Malta. The school is well known for its exemplary multicultural practices. As I met the headmistress and assistant heads, I explained that my colleagues and I will be embarking on a research project entitled Educating for Open-Mindedness that explores the educational experiences of migrant children in various primary schools. Would the school like to participate? At one point in our conversation, the head teacher exclaimed, "You know, they, for migrant children," and here I'm referring especially to sub-Saharan migrant children, "you know, they are more than welcome here. We are ready to do anything to ensure that they are well here, that they feel safe, and have all the material and educational opportunities that we can provide. But do not expect us, the school, to change for them. They come here and they are welcome, but they should fit in our routine, our ways, our customs. I cannot have children run in the corridor during religion lessons, for example. We cannot change. They came here and they need to change." The issue that I would like to highlight here is one of assimilation of migrant children and the justice in making migrant children become a bit more like us. The assimilation might be a consensual one, from the migrants that is, because as one colleague reminded me, but they came here. They have taken a difficult and long journey to come here. Surely they want to become a bit like us. What is sure is that the migrant children's identities are in transit. They are in transition. What is best for them? What do they want? To retain their native cultural originality or develop an identity which helps them to adapt more in the host country? Do they want to be assimilated into our systems or retain their cultural identities? The social philosopher and psychiatrist, he worked as a psychiatrist, Frantz Fanon, has written extensively about this issue and about the experiences of black people in a white world. In his well-known book, Black Skin, White Mask, he asked this very same question. What does a man want? What does the black man want? At the risk of arousing the resentment of my colored brothers, says Fanon, I will say that the black man is not a man. Fanon here is referring to the identity of a black man that has been lost in pursuit of some other identity that makes him more acceptable, more man. What does the black man want? Does he want to remain black or would he like to become white? Fanon here is highlighting the ambivalent experiences of black people in desiring to imitate the cultural ways of the dominant mainstream cultures and his struggles to become white. Drawing on Fanon's ideas, one can explain the feelings of inadequacy that migrants experience in white culture and their desire to embrace the culture of the country they have migrated to. Yet Fanon's idea is particular to the account that I have just narrated earlier on, is that educational institutions should be aware of, one, the migrant struggle to try to live as two different people at once, this hybridized split, as he calls it, the painfulness of trying to live two different identities. Number two, what education institutions should be aware of as well, I think, is that this disempowering alienation of migrants from their original identities, which takes place through educational systems and culture, is enhanced by the fact that migrants will always be considered as other. So even when they are successfully integrated into Maltese school cultures, migrants therefore will be considered as other, as migrants, never completely Maltese. They can never become Maltese. Fanon represents this schizophrenic existence through the idea of black skin, white masks. The white mask being the new identity that has been placed, or that the migrant himself has placed, on his real, essential one. Quote, overnight, the Negro has been given to frames of reference within which he has had to place himself. His metaphysics, or less pretentiously, his customs, and the sources on which they are based, were wiped out because they were in conflict with a civilization that he did not know and that imposed itself on him. And this is from, end quote, this is from his book, Black Skin, White Masks. Here, I do not intend and I do not have the time to explore the critiques that have been directed to Fanon's ideas. But what is important to our discussion tonight, I think, is the idea of hybrid identity. And that hybrid identity need not be understood as oppressive, as schizophrenic, as a violent imposition, as Fanon would have it. Feminist philosophers and theorists and other post-colonial theorists have moved away from understanding identity as a stable thing. Subjects are to be conceived in process. This is because their identities are not constituted only through one aspect of their being, that is the gender aspect, the cultural aspect, the age, or the sexual orientation, or their race. Their identities are more clearly understood through the multiple configurations that they live. Subjects are conceived in process also because they are formed through the particular power relations that allow them to move along powerful, powerless continuum. Subjects are conceived in process also because they are capable of re-articulating and reinventing their identity through living hybrid experiences. In this sense, the identities of black people or migrants are not totally constructed by the all-power colonizing educational system. Their very own activities as migrants conveys their subject in process, their act of migration, their state of flux, their ability to move, change, and not remain fixed in their oppressed location is their strength. Feminist philosophical representation of multiple identities has been mostly through particular figurations like those of the nomad, of the cyborg, of the mestiza. And they are clearly different from Fanon's concept of the mask. The change of identity cannot be removed to find the real self, as Fanon would have it, because identities themselves, they have become multiple. As Rosy Bradotti, another feminist philosopher, brilliantly puts it, the nomad has no passport, or he has too many of them. One last point, because I don't want to take much time, okay? One last point to consider in thinking about multiple identities is that identities are formed in relation to others. In my presentation, I have spoken about the multiple identities of migrant people, of the need to conceive their identities as multiple, and themselves to conceive their identities as multiple. To conclude, I want to argue, however, that it is not only migrants' identities that are in flux. The school's identities, for example, are clearly in a state of flux. And in spite of their resistance to change, as the headmistress' talk speech has so clearly emphasized, So in spite of their resistance to change and insisting on maintaining a stable identity, one cannot ignore, and the schools cannot ignore, the changing effects that the presence of local migrants are having on local schools. Just as it is empowering for migrants to conceive their identities as multiple, so do schools greatly benefit from taking the challenge of changing their identities. Thank you.
Okay, so it is my pleasure to introduce the last speaker, our guest speaker, Ms. Dyshar, who at the moment is a project manager of the Community Regeneration Unit at Bedford Community Housing Trust. She also lives, she resides in Bedford. Over the past decade, she has worked with disadvantaged, marginalized, and vulnerable communities and groups, with a particular focus on Bedford's hard-to-reach minority ethnic and migrant communities. Past experience includes coordinating the city's anti-racism project, focusing on developing youth-led activities to build tolerance, understanding, and encourage dialogue amongst Bedford's most excluded and hard-to-reach communities. I hope you enjoy the speech. Ms. Dyshar.
Thanks, Nick. Hello, everyone. Before we start, if anybody can't understand my accent or speak too fast, just let me know and it's not going to be a problem to slow down. Today I'm going to talk about immigration and multiple identities. First of all, I'd like to ask you what you consider my identity to be, just visually from looking at me. Well, initially, my mother is British, and I acquired my British passport when I was 18 years of age. Well, my father is from Ghana in West Africa. I live in Bradford, which is a city in the north of England. And this is a typical image of when people in England think of Bradford, they think of a large, predominantly Asian and Muslim community. So this is an image from the 1970s. It's a typical fish and chip shop where there's English and Urdu. I'm also a Christian, or specifically Roman Catholic, and I have a Maltese passport. Just to talk a little bit about myself, my mother and my elder brothers and siblings, we came to Malta, and I was born in Malta. And due to complications with marital and international law, I wasn't entitled to a Ghanaian passport or British passport, but the Maltese kindly offered me a Maltese citizenship. So this is just an example of my multiple identity. So the city of Bedford, where I live and work, is often in the news when questions of immigration and identity arise in the UK. Leicester, not Bradford, will be the first city in the UK where the majority of the population is going to be ethnic minority. So there will be more. There's a larger ethnic minority community than the indigenous white community. Birmingham and London are more ethnically diverse. However, Bradford is predominantly Pakistani and therefore Muslim, which is what concerns the media. Immigration in the UK. How immigration is regarded within a country depends upon that country's history and culture. Canada, Australia, and the United States are countries founded on immigration. All except for their small indigenous populations are immigrants or descendants from immigrants. So their cultures are far better placed to accept immigration as a way of life. Both Britain and Malta are traditionally countries of emigration, as you'll know from the Maltese community in Australia, for example. Britain has only been adjusting to be a country of immigration since the 1950s. Most immigration into the UK has been a result of the country's past colonial adventures. Britain had a huge empire that spanned the world, including Australia, Africa, and particularly the Caribbean. Immigrants coming into the UK often move into working class areas because that's where there's the jobs in terms of the manufacturing, that's where there's cheap accommodation. And when they arrive, it has been the working class that's had to accommodate the influx of new people from across the world. The manual trades in Bradford have begun to disappear, and the traditional white working class has had to make the adjustments to the new working environment. On many traditional social housing estates, where there's predominantly white communities, this has resulted in numerous social problems and an emerging underclass. So from my experience, on some of the peripheral social housing estates in which I work, it's been white young males that have felt marginalised and disadvantaged. They're leaving school with the lowest attainment levels. There's problems with numeracy and literacy, which obviously impacts upon their life chances. During the Second World War, the men who came from the colonies to join the British forces were well accepted in the UK. In the Imperial War Museum, there's photographical evidence of West Indians and Indians and Pakistanis who fought side by side with white soldiers. In the 1950s, when the same people were invited to return because of labour shortages, they got a very different reception. When people came in the 1950s from the new Commonwealth, from Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Jamaica, the experiences were that there was racism. And 40 years ago, last month in fact, Enoch Powell gave his infamous Rivers of Blood speech, which highlighted the concerns that Britain was losing its identity. It was being overrun by ethnic minorities. It was going to lose its cultural identity because it was no longer going to be white. You know, race and identity and culture was associated with the colour of someone's skin rather than the contributions that individuals had made. And since that time, it has been almost impossible to debate immigration without being accused of being a racist. There's so many connotations associated with the whole debate about immigration that people fear that there'll be a backlash. And for a long time, the British media, particularly the tabloid press, concentrated on asylum seekers and overstayers, but this has changed now with economic migration from people from Eastern Europe. For example, nobody knows how many new Polish workers are in the UK at the moment. The estimates is 750,000 Polish workers alone. However, three members of Margaret Thatcher's cabinet, Michael Howard, Leon Britton and Nigel Lawson, are the children of refugees. And this shows that refugees have been able to contribute to social reform in Britain. They have been involved in political society and they have made huge movements in Britain. And being a refugee did not necessarily have connotations with negative status. And David and Ed Miliband are also children of refugees, and they're in the present Labour cabinet. Genuine political refugees are now suffering the consequences of overuse of the system. In the 80s, up until the 1980s, it was quite easy for people to come to Britain. And people stayed, immigrants could stay. If they proved that they lived in Britain for 3 years, you're entitled to British citizenship. And now the whole immigration debate has meant that the rules on people claiming asylum has become tighter and it's more difficult for people to claim political asylum. And so now it just confused the whole agenda. You know, Britain is an island and has an island mentality. The UK differs from other European Union countries in that we have a Race Relations Act, and that came into power in became law in 1976. And with the 1976 Race Relations Act, organisations, companies and schools have introduced ethnic monitoring. There's monitoring with the census too. And so people's effectiveness and progress within establishments is seen through ethnic monitoring. The UK has some of the most comprehensive race equality laws. And because of the race equality laws, there is a baseline for identifying discrimination and racism in institutions. And in the 1990s, positive discrimination came into force because it was apparent that there was a significant institutional racism in the police force, in the National Health Service, and in the education establishment. So what happened was that the central government provided funds for, particularly in the public sector, to recruit ethnic people from the ethnic minority communities so that they could provide a better service to the British public. So, for example, in the police force, it was a predominantly white establishment, and in the 1980s, they were accused of being racist. In terms of stopping searches, African Caribbeans, when people saw an African Caribbean on the street, young man on the street, they automatically thought that he was a drug dealer or a pimp. And it was a way of breaking down some of the misconceptions. And in terms of African Caribbeans and Pakistan and the Asian communities, progressing in schools, it was important that they had positive role models, and it was felt that you needed more to recruit people specifically from the African Caribbean community and the Asian community so that there was some affiliation between the pupils that they were serving, and they knew about their cultural background and their language, and it also raised the profile. And nearly all Commonwealth immigrants are now UK citizens. The UK is the only country in the EU that doesn't have a constitution. We're not citizens. You know, we're subjects. We're British subjects. And it was the same case for people during the height of the Commonwealth, that people from Pakistan or Jamaica, they too were British subjects, and they were entitled to come to Britain because they were British subjects. The government is always talking about Britishness, but nobody seems to know what that means. So Bradford is a city of immigration. It's a city in the north of England, and it was a city of immigration long before the 20th century. In 1801, Bradford was a small market town. There was a population of just over 6,000 people. And during the Industrial Revolution, Bradford had a booming textile industry. It claimed to be one of the richest cities in Britain and was determined the wool capital of the world. French Huguenots and then Germans came to work in the wool trade. Irish came to build the canals and the railways. And at the turn of the century, of the last century, almost two-thirds of the flourishing textile businesses were German, and Italians came too. And this can be seen in Bradford. There's a German church, there's an Italian church, there's an Italian community centre. And after 1945, there were Jewish emigres, Poles, Ukrainians, Latvians, Estonians, Ukrainians, Yugoslavians, and Lithuanians added to the district's ethnic diversity, and there's evidence of the contributions and the social infrastructure that they set up today. There's Ukrainian, for example, there's a Ukrainian youth centre, a Lithuanian community centre. And they came to, because there was work in the mills. And then in the 1950s, immigrants came to Bradford from India and Pakistan, Bangladesh, East Africa, Jamaica, and the smaller Caribbean islands of Dominica, St. Kitts, and St. Lucia. And in Bradford, there is a Jamaican youth and community centre called Checkpoint. There's a Dominican community centre. And these communities often set up their own churches. It's really evident with the Pakistani community in the number of mosques that there are in Bradford. But there are also distinct churches that West Indians went to. And African Caribbeans contributed to the National Health Service. They built they were involved in the transport sector. So if anybody came to London in the 1980s, you'd see that from just the volume of African Caribbeans that worked on London Underground, it was like you had to spot the white person. And the mill owners had the choice of modernisation or importing cheap labour, and they chose the cheapest option. However, Bradford now is in manufacturing decline. The wool trade collapsed in the 1960s, and Bradford has been in decline ever since. Bradford is now one of Britain's poorest cities. However, for some reason, people have continued to come and stay in the city, including Vietnamese boat people, Bosnians, African and Iraqi asylum seekers, and now workers from Eastern Europe. The demography of Bradford. Bradford is the only city in the UK with a natural growth in its population. 50% of the babies born are South Asian, and from that I mean Pakistani or Bangladeshi parentage. The population of the district, which is larger than the city, is approximately 400,000. In the 2001 census, 98,000 were of Pakistani, Indian and Bangladeshi origin. 60,000 were of Irish origin. And I think that some of the white people in Bradford decided to claim their Irish heritage because Irish, being Irish, was quite trendy. And Ireland was becoming quite prosperous. And 6,800 were African Caribbean, and there's smaller communities of Poles, Lithuanians, Italians, Vietnamese, Filipinos, and Roma. Approximately 18% of the district's total population is ethnic minority. The majority are of ethnic minority population is of Asian origin, and a further 7%. Of African Caribbean origin. I think people accept diversity better than this suggests. I think in Bradford, racial diversity is a fact of life. Forecasters estimate that the district's population will continue to increase in the foreseeable future. By the year 2011, it is estimated that there will be almost 520,000 residents in the district, an increase of 8% from 1995. But by the year 2011, the Bradford Health Academy has estimated that the district's ethnic minority population will rise to 28% of the district's total population. A recent study by Leeds University has suggested that the figure will rise to 38.2% by 2030, and the South Asian population will comprise of 31.9% of that group. Spreading the love. Figures change all the time, and Africans now outnumber African Caribbeans in the UK for the first time. But the fastest growing group in the UK is mixed race or of dual heritage. And this population is also growing rapidly in Bradford, with 12,000 plus who are of dual heritage. How is Bradford coping with its changing population? Well, to be quite frank, it's not. The evidence is shown through the Cantrell and Ouse reports about Bradford, and these reports highlight that there is polarity between communities. There are some of the Asian, some of the schools are 95% South Asian, and there are neighbourhoods in the city which are 80% ethnic minority. Bradford is experiencing the phenomenon of white flight. 75% of Muslims would have to move to white neighbourhoods to get an equal distribution of ethnic communities. The indigenous white community of Bradford have moved to the suburbs or into more rural areas because in the inner city communities, that is where, due to housing and work, that is where the ethnic minority communities reside because that's where their employment is and it's what is affordable. Following the 2001 riots, Ted Cantor reported that communities are living parallel lives. The ethnic minority community and the indigenous white community were living side by side with little interaction, social interaction between the two. The polarisation of communities on social, ethnic and religious grounds led and continues to lead to increased racial tensions. In 2007, of the 28 secondary schools in Bradford, in the Bradford district, 10 had 90% or more pupils from one community, and that included having 90% of pupils from a wholly Pakistani community or a wholly white community. The term multiculturalism is loaded. Strategies, money has been invested by central government and local government into investing and building social capital so that each ethnic community had the status and people had the opportunity to have advocates within their community. There were places where people could go for information, for advice. And the funding of community centres, it was the state's way of saying, oh, we recognise your language, your culture and your religion, and we realise that there's a natural affiliation to people from specific cultural or ethnic backgrounds to want to have somewhere safe to meet and something that they can call theirs. And as British citizens, you're entitled to that. And social infrastructure was particularly important when racial minorities were discriminated against, particularly when racism was acute in the 70s and 80s. In the 1950s and 60s, it was quite common in Britain to have, in some place, like for hotels, for instance, to have, no Irish, no black, no dogs, no blacks. So, and there was institutional racism, and there was racism in terms of the fact that in how people were paid, blacks and Asians that were doing the same jobs as their white counterparts were often paid less. Investing in social infrastructure encouraged ethnic minorities to have a voice. And through community centres and then building social capital, you know, they had the opportunity to... Communities became empowered and they were able to seek redress for discrimination and to become more equal. It was thought that strong communities would give a new and exciting dimension to UK society as a whole, and the cultural differences would be underpinned by a shared cumulity of country and nationhood. But the communality hasn't happened. In some South Asian women live exclusively in their own communities, and they've had little interaction with the indigenous white community. Some immigrants, particularly South Asian women, have lived in Bradford for 30 or 40 years, they hold British passports but do not speak any English. Some community groups, particularly in the Pakistani and Bangladeshi residential areas, have gatekeepers, and these are usually older men. They have been the advocates of that community. They have been the door to the wider community. They have been the ones that have consulted and said that this is what their community needs, and without necessarily having evidence of that, what they're purporting to represent, that is represented. And particularly within the Pakistani and Bangladeshi community, women have not had the same status as men. The gatekeepers have had power and control. You know, the younger generation have broken away from this tradition, but it is still there for the older generation. And even today, it's traditional for Pakistanis and Bangladeshis, second, third generation in Bradford, to be married from people back home. And they do not speak English. In multiculturalism in practice, there are no rites of passage for the first wave of Commonwealth immigrants. They had the right to stay or come to work and go home. You know, the choice was theirs. You know, they were entitled to British citizenship. They were British subjects. Many continue to hold two nationalities and live between the homeland and the UK. This was both mentally and physically, and is aggravated by class. In Bradford, a lot of the Pakistani and Bangladeshi communities came from rural areas where they were illiterate in their mother tongue and often uneducated. That's not to say that all immigrants, most immigrants to Britain are educated. But in the South Asian community in Bradford, it was a practice that they came from rural communities, from rural villages. The situation is not synonymous with all ethnic groups. Indians cannot hold dual nationality, and so to become British, you had to make a choice on whether you became, unless you remained Indian or British. The African Caribbean community has much more in common with the indigenous community in terms of the language, Christianity, education systems, sports. Like if you see the English Premier League, for example, you know, the majority of like Arsenal and Manchester United are black players, so it's quite accepted that they are in positions where they're paid like £200,000 a week, for example. And when you look at the British Olympic team, there are lots of British people. The athletes are majority black. However, since 9/11, there has been a growing concern about culture and Islamophobia is replacing racism, even within the racist British National Party. Colour is increasingly of less importance than culture. And due because of polarisation of communities in Bradford, it's quite common that extremes of ideologies are becoming popular amongst even the Muslim community and the British white community. And 2 years ago in Bradford alone, 18,000 people voted BNP. So there's not that much. It discredits multiculturalism in Bradford. Multiculturalism has been discredited. There's evidence of a growing gang culture amongst young African Caribbean men. Even though older African Caribbeans have positions of power and influence within, for example, the NHS and the transport service and the youth. The majority of youth and community workers within Bradford are either of Pakistani origin or African Caribbean origin. The younger generation do not feel that there's been enough progress within the African Caribbean community, and there is residual racism. In the current climate, the Muslim community are feeling increasingly victimised and withdraw into their own communities. And as the Muslim communities become stricter, women are more constrained culturally. Questions are now being raised as to how some cultural practices can be reconciled with a legal right to sexual equality. And I think that in Bradford, it's becoming more evident that you saw that more Pakistani and Bangladeshi women are veiled or at the minimum wearing the hijab, and children are following the practice of Ramadan at a younger age. And so that I think that their identity, because of the political climate, is focusing not on their sense of being British, but on the sense of their religious identity. Diversity is a new buzzword in Britain. Diversity places a greater importance on the need to nurture the common identity, for Britishness to underpin differences, for multiple identities to have a common root in nationality and culture. But diversity starts with a need to have a common identity, with a space for additional multiple identities. And in Britain, there is a lack of common identity because nobody really understands what being British means or is. In Scotland and Wales, there is this growing distinct identity. And within Britain, people that are Scottish and Welsh have a multiple identity in the fact that they are Scottish and British, Welsh and British. But nobody seems to be able to say what being English means. For example, the St. George flag is associated with extreme political right and with the BNP and the National Front. So I think this is one of the main concerns, is that people just have no idea what being British is other than having a British passport. The challenges. Sky News 3 years ago stated that Muslims place more importance on religion than on nationality, whilst the white community place more importance on nationality. Many unspoken inferences were made. An additional and comprehensive survey was then undertaken in Bradford amongst all the communities. The results were as expected. Given the opportunity to indicate the importance of religion, nationality and ethnicity from 1 to 10, the ethnic minority groups placed more importance on all three than the white respondents. Very few of the white respondents gave any of the three concepts more than a value of 5. Very few ethnic minority respondents gave a value of less than 6 for any of them. The multiple identities debate. If a common identity is to be the base on which other identities rest, then the UK must be more definitive about what that common identity is. For example, for me, I feel that I can, that I am British, my mother is British, and I have been, a lot of my family reside in England. Majority of my education was in England, and my friends are in England. But I also owe Malta to owe loyalty to Malta. You know, I have Maltese citizenship that no one can take that away from me, even though sometimes it raises eyebrows that I'm black and Maltese. And also, the fact that I am black, it cannot be ever you know, for me, I also owe part of my cultural heritage to my father, you know, for the fact that I have an African identity too. So the move forward is to move towards an integrated society. An integrated society is not sought on assimilation, accommodation, or lip service, but a commitment to ideals of equality, respect, and human rights. And the international problems, particularly facing the Muslims in Bradford, is then there's new tensions that are forging identity and determining loyalties. Good race relations is founded on tolerance, understanding between communities, and strong community leadership with democratic values. There are new migrants in Bradford. They've come here, they've come to Bradford for jobs, and they're more than it's more than likely that they're going to move around Europe dependent on where there is employment for them. But the issue that is the same in Bradford as it is in Malta is how will they be absorbed? You know, the children will be going to school in Bradford. Will their families remain outsiders? And if they leave, does it matter? Is there any kind of responsibility for ensuring that children of Polish and Slovakian economic migrants are involved in and feel part and are embraced in British society and culture? Because whatever happens, even if they do move on, as in Malta and in Bradford, when people come to a country in significant numbers, they will have an impact on the social fabric of that of the indigenous communities. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Hello. Can you say something about the greatest difficulties and also the greatest successes that you have, that you know about in multiculturalism, maybe the most surprising successes in bringing people together from different communities?
So in what context was that in terms of...?
I'm just trying to get, you know, to some lessons that we can take away, not just facts and figures about... you know, how many people there are of each community, but what can we learn from your experiences? That's what I'm trying to get to.
Well, in terms of the kind of work that I do, I'm employed by a housing association, one of the largest housing associations in the north of England. And one of the roles that I have is about setting up community education programmes and social inclusion programmes in deprived and disadvantaged neighbourhoods. And that's not specifically to the Asian community or the African Caribbean community. It's about providing opportunities for people to fulfil their potential in terms of educational attainment, in terms of accessing the labour market, and providing opportunities through social interaction or through community education programmes that go beyond language but build tolerance and understanding. So some of the activities that that we've established are things like cook and eat programmes and using food as a way of getting people from a broad range of ethnic minority groups to come together and explore their own cultures and identity through food and using that as a starting point. And also because specifically with South Asian women, one of the things is that there's a lack of opportunity for them to integrate with other community groups. In terms of community education programs, as a housing association, you know, we funded language programs, initial first stage language programs, where it's about engaging with people initially and doing English language through art or doing Mendy courses. You know, Mendy, which is... What's Mendy? Mendy, henna. Through, yeah, there's another name for it. Through henna. And just to break down some of the barriers between, or some of the differences between groups. And music is a fantastic way of engaging with young people. And as you'll see tomorrow, there's an example of a graffiti arts project that we've done with young people, with Slovakian and Pakistani young people, where we've asked them to look at issues within their neighbourhood through a graffiti arts project, and using that as a medium for engaging with people and then moving them on. And in some instances, it's about the barriers to people entering education or employment. Is the biggest thing is language or lack of information. So it's about getting universities and colleges to come and deliver programs in neighborhoods because it's more accessible. Is that okay?
I really enjoyed your talk, and Simone's before yours as well. And I lived in the UK for about 7 years, lived and worked in the UK, and I could really identify with a lot of the things that were being said. I was Maltese, still am. I spoke English better than most English people did. I had a very good accent, as in not very strongly Maltese when I am in England, although it becomes much more Maltese when I'm in Malta. But I was never, never English. And I could never be English. And I didn't want to be English, but then, as a result, I never fitted in English. I was never 100% at home. And whenever I came back here, I was never 100% here. And it's taken me years, I mean, longer years than I was away, to fit back in here and feel again that I am, you know, back in... I am at home. I am at home. I can see how many of the Asian communities, the South Asian communities, have become stronger, as in their cultural identity and so on has become stronger because their otherness has increased because of the threat since
9/11.
Since 9/11, they are perceived more as a threat. They are perceived more as other, and part of the reaction to that is that you become stronger in yourself, and that is part of. What happened in Malta as a result of colonization, which I'm sure happened elsewhere as well, that when we were the natives as opposed to the colonizers, our Maltese identity actually forged around our religion. And as a result, Roman Catholicism in Malta, as you, I'm sure you know, if you have lived here at all, is extremely, extremely strong, much stronger than it is in many other places. And part of that was a reaction to our otherness, as far as the people who had the power were concerned. So it's just that it's just happening again and again and again. Do you know what I mean?
But as you know, one of the things about being English and being British is that being English is associated, even if you are third generation and you're born in England, you know, ethnic minority people don't feel that they can call themselves English. You know, to be English, you have to be white. You have to be of Anglo-Saxon blood lineage. But it's okay to be called, to say that you're British, because being British encapsulates the global dimension. So I understand completely.
I have a question, and I think here we are putting quite a lot of responsibility on ethnic minorities as such. But how about the role of the host society of Britain? How do they perceive the ethnic minorities? Do they really are willing to embrace them? Or are they making lives a bit easier? Are they themselves ready to learn about other cultures? Because it's again creating another niche for them. having just the ethnic minorities getting together without the participation of British themselves. So I don't know how is the situation there. You can tell me.
Well, I think that in the from the 1950s, you know, I'm not saying that Britain is not a racist country. There's evidence that there has been significant racism in the past, but with the 1976 Race Relations Act, there's a lot. British citizens were protected, and the Commission for Racial Equality, you know, fought hard to ensure that the playing field became more equal between the Indigenous white community and the British immigrant community. And there is there was a notion of positive discrimination where in underrepresented service sectors, particularly like the police and the National Health Service, there were programs where African Caribbeans, Indians, Pakistanis were recruited into middle management training programs in order to be able to shape policy from the inside out. And then in the past 5 years, there's been the introduction of citizenship education in primary and secondary schools, and it's compulsory education. And there has been a move with citizenship education to incorporate the role that the British Empire has had in shaping British identity in terms of the slavery, the Commonwealth, how the economy in Britain was basically built and founded on the exploitation and the colonisation of the Indian subcontinent and Africa through slavery, through gold, through the sugar plantations, and that is acknowledged, and also the contributions that the Commonwealth, the non-white communities, how they contributed towards the Allies in the British Allies winning the Second World War, because it was a world war, not just a European war. So that is being taught in schools to try and shape the sense of what Britishness is. So the contributions are recognised. And also in terms of the political, you know, positions of power, there's children of refugees in the Labour Party, in the former Conservative Party. There are African Caribbeans in senior positions in the police force, the Metropolitan Police Force. And I think that slowly, you know, these role models are shaping how services are being provided to British society, because there are people in positions of power that can influence change. Does that answer your question? Sorry.
Yeah, to some extent, I think it does. You said somewhere that British society is not racist. I don't have really any evidence, but...
British society is racist.
Oh, you said it. Okay, yeah. Because I was like, I heard it is not racist, and I wondered. Whenever I walk there, I do hear this word Paki quite a lot. You see, my parents live there. My parents live in Sheffield. Mm. And every time I go there, I don't really feel that comfortable there. Yeah.
No, there is a history of acute racism in Britain. And particularly in the 1970s, when there was the following Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, there were the Teddy riots in Toxteth and South London. And the thing is that put, you know, Britain and racism was put on the international agenda. And even in 2001 with the Bradford race riots, that was a response to the evidence of discrimination, the fact that why are Asian and African Caribbean children underachieving in schools? Why is it the fact that there are communities in Bradford where there is like Asian enclaves? You know, the fact that people feel that they have to live together shows that there isn't, multiculturalism is not working or hasn't worked. And yeah, there are people that are ignorant, and they can't say that everybody's tolerant and that there is no racism or prejudice, because there is. But I think that systems and programs have invested in trying to counteract that through social inclusion programs and through positive discrimination.
As you were talking, lots of things came to mind, but one of the things that struck me is the notion of multiple identities in terms of how we Maltese are looking to immigrants. Because I think that notion is important for us, because I think, because, as Marceline was saying, we have been colonized, and I think we've identified so much with the underdog that this sort of identity of the underdog, and now suddenly we're feeling that there's these others who are even more underdog than we are. I don't believe that. I'm just saying that. It's somehow, I mean, this notion of you always have to have someone who's lesser than you. I think that's bringing out an identity in us that we're uncomfortable with, don't know really how to live with it. And I think it's something that we really need to reflect a lot about, because, I mean, I find it very hard to think of Malta being an immigrant country rather than an emigrant country. I studied in Australia, so I met lots of Maltese migrants. A lot of the things you were saying about, you know, people being there for 40 years and not speaking a word of English were the sort of things I encountered. So I've always identified as my identity of being, you know, with the immigrants. Mm-hmm. So suddenly now we sort of have these people coming in. And I think it's a reflection. The multiple identities is a helpful notion in terms of, you know, not so much as who we are as Maltese. I think that's also something in flux. But who we are as Maltese, and Malta is multicultural, is becoming multicultural, and that's a positive thing. And I think that's something that perhaps, you know, Britain is struggling with, but Malta's struggling with perhaps as much, if not more. Definitely. So I felt that was useful in terms of, you know, what can we learn in terms of our local context.
But I suppose what aggravates a problem in Britain is that a lot of the people that are feeling excluded are British themselves, while in Malta, they're not Maltese.
One of the things that you, when you were speaking, one of the things that you said were that common identity is to be the base on which other identities rest, then the UK must be more definite about what this common identity is. Now, don't you think that this defining what the British identity was, defining an identity, is a bit dangerous, in the sense that you create another category of others? I don't know in what sense you spoke about the need. You were not arguing, I suppose, for the need to have a definition of a common identity, or what do you think about that?
I think what I was trying to explain is that people do not understand what being British entails. You know, ethnic monitoring on the census reports, you can be British African, British African Caribbean, you can be mixed parentage, you can be British white, British Irish, British other, you know, and I think it's just, and then there's the, from British Indian, British Pakistani, British Bangladeshi, you know, then there's Chinese. There's about 20 different categories of being British. And I think it's just nonsensical that there needs to be some kind of common framework to move forward, that there's a shared identity that goes beyond colour or religion or the passport that people hold. This needs to, in order to move forward in a positive framework where it doesn't focus on those that are Muslim or those that are Christian or those that are Pakistani or white, there needs to be some kind of common identity, and nobody knows what that is other than citizenship.
I'm particularly intrigued by the community work involvement just a small statement. I think it's really positive rather than reactive, and draws on the individual's potential, on the community's potential. And the gentleman over there some minutes ago asked about what can we take away, and I think that is something that we need to address. I think on a level of welfare and benefits in Malta, we seem to be doing quite well to a certain degree, but most needs are generally catered for. But when it comes to actually engaging the community and communities, instead of having, for example, people in open centers doing nothing, spending the whole days doing nothing, and then we are questioning the amount of resources they're taking from this country, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that is one strategy one strategy we need to consider adopting, possibly.
Well, I think that the amount of resources that have been put in through public sector to provide services, and particularly by NGOs initially, Britain has a really large charitable and community sector that I'm not sure that has that kind of infrastructure in Malta. But in Britain, it's really important that there is a move towards social, as part of integration, there's a move towards social inclusion. And with inclusion, it's about tackling some of the barriers to why people are excluded. And that's as much to do about with education and employment as anything else. And so for organisations that I've worked, so the youth and community sector in Britain is really established, and there's peer education programmes, there's peer mentoring programmes and youth empowerment programmes, and that has sought to, you know, redress some of the imbalances between the indigenous and the ethnic minority communities.
There was, in fact, a conference yesterday morning on sexual and gender-based violence in relation to the immigrant population within the Mediterranean, which was very good and very interesting. And there are many of these issues were touched upon anyway, issues of language and teaching English, and they are not only state projects that do that, but also many voluntary organizations who do that voluntarily. In the open centres, in the various homes for refugees and asylum seekers or humanitarian people with humanitarian status. There was also the issue that you mentioned in relation to the women are becoming more isolated because of the thing, and that too is an issue. So one of the things that they're looking at providing is actually gender education, gender equality education to all, not just to the women, but to the women and men. And this was discussed, and we also have a system of cultural mediators who are people who are from the immigration population, but they actually mediate between. They are not only interpreters, but they're cultural mediators, and they mediate between the two cultures, including, you know, what is acceptable here and what is not, and what is acceptable here and what is not, and how we can work within that. There is a state agency that works with not only young people, but in relation to employment, etc. They're all under resourced, don't get me wrong. But we do have we do have these things. They are in place. We just need lots more of them, really.
That will happen with time. And once the immigrant community mobilise themselves so that they develop their own social infrastructures, then there will be advocacy within those communities.
They cook their traditional meals. They have two or three restaurants where they cook their own traditional meals, and you know, people from their own ethnic communities go there. In San Juan now we have I forget what it's called, but it's a shop with No, it's not just halal, but it has a whole load of things. It has a lot of spices and... I don't know who said halal, but... No, halal meat, yes. And there are many butchers that sell halal meat, but it wasn't just... It's not just... It's not actually a meat shop. It's not actually a specific butcher shop. It's a food shop more general. And it's relatively new because I only spotted it the other day and I pass through San Juan quite regularly. So it has, you know, foods that people can find in other cultures. Like, well, I mean, when I lived in England, if I found, you know, like fennel, a fennel bulb or whatever, I used to get so excited, you know, because here you can get them. No, never kinny, and never twisties either.
So if there are any more questions... If there are no more questions, I think we can call it a day. Thank you for joining us
and
for joining in the discussion. Thanks, Mina, for your lecture. It's been a pleasure having you here. And hope to see you tomorrow on half-day conference tomorrow at the National Curriculum Center in Hamroon. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies in collaboration with the Department of Education, entitled Approaches to Immigration and Multiple Identities. This talk was delivered by Ms. Mina Dye-Sharp, Project Manager of the Bradford Community Housing Trust in the UK.